Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. Today, our guest is Jean Drennan. She is a medically retired occupational therapist with certifications in various integrative and manual therapies, including neuromuscular therapy, lifestyle medicine, stress and chronic disease management, and zero balancing. Her intention is always to help patients regain their desired level of independence by empowering them with practical tools to help them safely and confidently navigate their environments and return to the activities that they once loved. This holistic approach can often uncover root causes, which can then lead to what we're all looking for, better long-term outcomes. As a health writer and lover of the written word, Jean authored a book in 2014 called Live Well, Be Well, 14 Habits to Extraordinary Wellness, highlighting 14 healing habits for wellness. Additionally, Jean has loved getting to be involved in several Spondylitis Association of America writing projects over the last few years. And in 2019, along with her amazing co-leader, they started and co-led New Mexico's first patient support group. Jean also contributed one of the chapters to the Spondylitis Association's new book, Straight Talk. As an OT with chronic health conditions, including spondylitis, she offers a unique perspective regarding disease management, energy conservation, and navigating life with invisible disabilities. Jean, thank you for joining SpondyCast. We're going to talk about occupational therapy to maximize functionality. Welcome.
I am so happy to be here, Jill. Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
All right. So we're very excited. One question I like to ask up front, and I'm going to go directly to the weeds, is how did you end up as an occupational therapist?
Such a good question. I was actually a very non-traditional student. I went back to college when my first daughter was a year old and really didn't know what I had wanted to do. But I landed in occupational therapy because in 1986, my sister was in a horrific motorcycle accident. Her and her friend were hit by a drunk driver and he was killed. So she turned 16 in a coma at our only level one trauma center in the city, in the state. And I watched it was horrific. I watched the doctors save her life. And then I watched the therapist give her back her quality of life. And that was OT speech and PT. And I said, I have to do that. I have the gift of encouragement, I'm told. And occupational therapy is, it's just one big, come on, you can do it. So it's just giving people the tools and the encouragement that they need to come back from something like that and just to live their best life in their body and whatever that means to them.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And it's amazing how you took what must have been a very deeply emotional situation.
Yeah, very much so.
Your ability to probably connect with patients ongoing has got to be like credible. Wow. So when you talk about the you can do it attitude, what is the role of OT or occupational therapy in for people with spondyloarthritis?
So we can come in many different areas, from something like just a referral from their primary or the rheumatologist for splinting. That's something that we do, mostly hand splinting, nighttime splints, things like that. But more so, it is around the independence in their environment, because I never want a patient to not do what they want to do. I want to remove those barriers for them to be able to do that. So, I mean, we will do in-home evals, and just to see, is their home safe? What can I do to make it easier for them? How can they return to things that they love to do? Because when you're in, you know, when you have a chronic illness, like we both know, and it keeps you from doing things that you love to do, or where you found kind of your identity and your meaning, we've got to get them back to where they can, even if they're doing it in a different way. For example, an avid gardener who was, out there all day, and they can't. You can't be sitting like that, bending over. It's hard on the neck. So, some things we might do there would be, you can still do that, but we'll do it differently. Maybe you'll be standing up at a potting table or whatever. Things for kneeling, things, chairs with wheels that you can scoot around, in your garden. We'll just do whatever it takes to get them to do what they want to do safely.
Yeah. And right. So a lot of us, at least I know for me, I've been in a lot of physical therapy, but what is the main difference between OT and PT?
At a very generic level, we'll say that when people think of those two therapies, they think of PT for exercise and OT will help you find a job. And so the occupation is the occupation of living. So we use your daily, and not to say OT and PT work so beautifully together. We, co-treat quite a bit, and also with speech, because speech isn't just this, it's cognition and things like that, executive functioning and so on. So we do work very well together. But again, our focus is not to say that PT is not holistic. Our focus is holistic in that I'm not just looking at whatever your injury is. We're looking at you, your whole body, and how that fits into what your life is going to be like now. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. I've never heard it described that way, but that's really interesting. Do you have, I want to get into techniques, but okay. Do you have any like amazing, crazy success stories that you could share?
I feel like they all are, because to see somebody go from, oh my gosh, I have this, I'm never going to be able to do whatever, fill in the blank. And then to get them to see, oh, wait a minute, I can do that. Maybe it's going to look a little different, but I can still do it. For example, somebody who might have been, avid in martial arts, there's a lover of martial arts. Well, that's not necessarily, you can do it. I mean, I've done it with spondylitis, but it can be dangerous. But so sure. If you can't do that anymore, then what about Tai Chi? You're still doing a lot of those movements, but they're slowed down and they're more purposeful and much, much safer.
Oh, that's interesting. And then like from a technique standpoint, are there approaches you found particularly effective
with martial arts and
with OT in general? Was everyone so different?
They really are, and it depends on what it is you're wanting to get back to. A lot of things focus around the kitchen, okay? Because eating well is very important to people with chronic illness. Well, we tend to have to make all of our own food too, especially in the beginning when we're trying to, just have more of an anti-inflammatory lifestyle. So that means then you are having to cook all your own meals. That's exhausting. Absolutely exhausting. So what some of the things that we've done is set up like batch cooking days, but not by yourself. you bring in your help, whether it's family, friends, whatever, you've got somebody washing dishes so that you can do what you can do, whether that's on a stool. We'll bring in, a stool that can raise so that they can be sitting at the island, because standing is exhausting, you know, as we know, so that everybody has their own kind of job. It's getting done. You're having socialization, which is so important for people with chronic illness, because we do tend to, become a little bit more isolated. So it's a great thing, like I said, socially and physically, because you're also, you're moving, you're getting your exercise. And then we'll bring in, the tools to make that job easier, whether it's built up handles on utensils like, potato peelers or whatever. So just to make that grasp wider, things like that, different types of bowls that have maybe handles on them. So you're not just trying to, grab with your whole hand, just trying to make it as easy as possible on the body. Okay. So that they will live their life.
You're making me think of one of my nemesis situations in life. So as water bottles, as the bottle caps have gotten smaller and thinner, and I think I have some small joint dysfunction going on, though I'm not going to let anyone tell me that's what it is. I can't get the lids off the bottle. Like, I can't unscrew the bottles. I can't get my fingers around them enough. Do you have any tips for that? Because that is, that's one of the toughest things I find about the way my body reacts to this.
Are you talking about the small ones on like just the regular little water bottles? So they're super, smaller than what you just showed me. Yeah, those are terrible. Oh, yeah, for sure.
That's the only one I've got handy if anybody's watching.
They're like, we're not watching. They do make, it's a device that you can put on there to turn it. But you know what? I don't think they make them that small. That's a good question. They're usually for the larger lids.
Yeah, they're so small. And as the plastic gets thinner, because everyone's trying to be sustainable, they get even smaller. Okay. So maybe we can come up with something new. We just developed a new product.
We did. Let's do it, Jill.
Get me a patent attorney right now.
I better write this down. We will forget.
But the other one I remember is like chopping. I can remember when I was sort of coming back into wellness, having super fatigue after trying to chop. I mean, I stopped making things that required a knife for a while. And then standing in the kitchen, it was like, how do you stand in the triangle and not put all your weight in one place? But any for like chopping or knives, do you have any, or I guess utensils?
So, yeah. So building up those handles you can buy them built up or you can just, we can make them, but that is helpful. But sometimes the knife is even too heavy. So I like to grade the activities. We'll start with absolute easiest and then we'll just make them, not increasingly not difficult, but you know what I'm saying? So that they're less manipulated, I guess. So what I would say in the beginning is either someone else chops them for you or you buy them pre-chopped. Because it's not even worth it. It's not until you can build up your strength and your energy. That's not where you need to put that energy. You need to put that energy to, like, if you're still working, to that, to showering, that kind of stuff. But I would definitely buy them chopped up, like at Trader Joe's has all of that stuff in itty bitty cute containers. So it's not like Costco where, oh my gosh, I'm going to feed my neighborhood.
Oh, believe me. Trader Joe's is a godsend, right?
Aren't they great? I love them.
Oh.
And then a mini.
Yeah, for the chopped veggies.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then they have their shredded chicken. They've got all that. It's fantastic. They charge you for it, but you're paying for convenience. But a mini, not a full-size food processor, just a small chopping one. It has a large kind of stopper thing on it, and you can just, you know, you can do.
And oh, so that, yeah, I used to have one of those. It was like a Pampered Chef thing.
Exactly.
It probably made, okay, I remember having that. Yeah. I haven't thought about that in a while. Okay. Yep, I'm going to have to like see if that's still in the cupboard. So I will admit that I cook about once every 6 to 8 weeks. I so make not eggs and, you know, well, you know what? It just doesn't serve me. Like literally, I just,
yeah,
I travel a lot and I have found that I'm not going to pretend to do the things that don't make me happy.
That is really
being at home.
That is really smart. Seriously. Yeah.
It's the plan. So mm-hmm. sometimes it doesn't work for everybody else, but it works for me currently.
And just because you did something pre-illness doesn't mean we have to do it, you know, post-illness. Because like you said, not everything we did before serves us now.
So, no, and I think pre-illness, I was more trying to like satisfy everyone around me. Mm-hmm. And now I just try to be very choosy about that.
It's funny and how that happens.
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of, I read a lot of inspirational quotes to get to that point.
Right.
Here we are. So can we talk about, okay, in techniques, what is zero balancing? This is a new term to me.
Zero balancing is an amazing therapy. So it is, it's a hands-on therapy, and it is across, it has its roots in chiropractic. But the developer is he is a medical doctor. So that's, and I had to, that's how I resonated with it. Cause I can't just be like, I don't know, woo woo or whatever. It had to have medical evidence that this works, you know? So it's very, very gentle. The, you know, clients are, you know, fully dressed on a massage table on their back. And, I basically go through and I work the joints that don't get a lot of movement in them, like yes, side joint. And I essentially am creating space in those joints. And then you train the base, hold it, and then it releases the energy flow. I mean, we all have that in our bodies, and we have blockages. And it's interesting, the first move is at the feet. I start at the feet and it's kind of pulling the legs a little bit. And I can tell where their block is by how far that kind of goes up their body. Because I'll ask them like most people, it's stopped in their hips. So we're having these kind of energy blocks. And it makes sense. I mean, anything from the hips down is carrying an enormous, it's got a huge job to do. You know, getting right. The body moving around. So it's creating that space, and it's not temporary. And it's almost like it's kind of opened the floodgates, and my clients would continue to have those releases for a month or two, even after the initial session.
Wow.
Yeah. It's profound.
I might have to come to New Mexico. I've never heard of that before.
Wonderful.
Okay. So let's talk about, well, occupational therapy is the occupation of life, but like, how does it tie into the work environment once we get there?
So with the work environment, we would work with the ergonomics of somebody's workspace to make it. And it doesn't have to necessarily be somebody with an illness or a condition. I mean, having healthy workspaces is important for everyone, but particularly for us, we would go into someone's workspace and see how that we can make that support them the best way. That's lighting. Lighting is
really.
When you think about just the fluorescent lights, I mean, do they affect you? Can you tell?
No, probably. I don't. I tend to be nowhere very long. So lately, but I mean, I've been somebody who, I was a remote worker since 2000.
Okay.
And with a heavy travel schedule on and off, mm-hmm. just being inside and not and stuck at a desk actually just doesn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
I can handle a day or two. But after that, it's just, I think it saved me from having the spondylitis set in until much later in life because I was always on the move.
Oh, 'cause you were moving.
Yeah. I was in motion.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So trying to, I like to get back to that, but I could see how, okay. So lighting, I didn't mean to digress.
So the lighting, so that's okay. I do that all the time. It's like, I'm talking to myself.
Yeah.
Those lights are so offensive. Like they, I mean, to your nervous system, they're just, but anyway, that's a side note. We would assess, you know, the chair and, the, you know, just if you're on, if they're on their computer all day, that distance, I think what would be great for everyone would be, you know, the adjustable desk so that you can stand, you can sit, you know, especially for us, we have to be able to get up and change positions. I mean, every 20 minutes.
Yeah. Maybe. Every 20 minutes, you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I can't even, I mean, you can say I'm already fidgeting and we've only been on for 20 minutes. but
for sure.
Yeah.
My mother used to call me a fidget. That was like my nickname.
I had that nickname. Mm-hmm. And motor mouth, both. But anyway.
Well, I won't say what of the mouth my family used to say.
That's so funny. But yeah, so just if someone is in their office and they are spending, you know, 8 hours a day there, it has to support them. I mean, mentally and physically, because if this drains, the body's going to drain.
Do you by chance have a particular chair that you like for people? Like an office chair?
No, because I mean, everybody's so different. Yeah. And it's been a while since I've done ergonomics in someone's, you know, office. So,
yeah, I've been thinking about that. Okay. So let's talk about, occupational therapy integrated. We talked a little bit with PT, but generally also with medication. And biologics is all okay.
What do you mean? I'm sorry. I think you cut out.
Like as part as just having OT is used in combination with medication and a variety of other things and and a coordination of care of a larger, like a holistic care.
You know, it would be ideal if everybody had an OT on their team. Like there would be, if everybody had a team, that would be great. But we know, I mean, you know, medical care is suffering, you know, for sure. Ideally, it would be amazing to have the primary rheumatologist and whoever else, if they've got other issues, you know, and then OTPT and speech, if it was necessary, that would serve the patient the best. But as you know, as it stands, you know, we'll get a referral, either from primary or for, you know, rheumatology. And it's usually for splinting. But again, you know, remember I've been medically retired for a bit. So, I'm not sure if they are utilizing OT yet for more lifestyle things, because that's what's going to keep everyone with a chronic condition. That's what's going to keep them well.
Yeah. The hacks.
So, yeah.
Are huge.
So huge.
So if you're somebody who's a patient and you go to see your rheumatologist, how would you maybe broach the subject of I think I need to have some OT?
I mean, I would just say it just like that. And they're going to know what it is. You're going to have to say why so that they can write for it. Right. So it could be, I mean, it could be for pacing. That's huge. For chronic illness is to be able to pace yourself, and then the grading of activity. Right. I mean, and if nothing else for new patients, and seeing a therapist that has, experience or familiar, you know what I'm trying to say, that is familiar with the mouth, familiar with, what OT can do for a patient, that would be, because not, I mean, really not everybody is.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about occupational therapy as a long-term management strategy? Does somebody just go to see an occupational therapist for 6 months and then they never go back? Or is it an ongoing relationship?
It's unfortunately, like everything else, it's dictated by insurance. So yeah, we won't get very much unless there's an injury. So that's unfortunate. A lot of people are going private pay now. And in the last part of my career, I didn't take insurance and I did mostly hands-on stuff. So that's a problem. But documenting the effectiveness, of it, and it has really helped the patient, the doctor can write for it and just hope it happens. Yeah. That's why it's bad. Yeah. It's, and who suffers? The patients suffer.
Right.
That's a whole nother soapbox that you probably don't want me to get on, but
on that soapbox sometimes.
Okay.
But that's go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's why this kind of stuff and the things that, the book, the Straight Talk, and the things that Spondylitis Association does and really offers at no cost for patients, it's invaluable. It really is.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, mm-hmm. I more and more think about how we get more momentum in the awareness of the disease and more funding for the research and more funding to.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that is it. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people who listen to this and have this disease lay awake at night like I do. Because we have spondylitis and that's what we do.
Right. We have insomnia. We can't sleep.
Right. Because our joints are gelling. But I also lay awake and think about we need to increase the awareness so the dollars flow, or we're never gonna hit mission, which is to find a cure and create better outcomes.
Yes.
It is, and it's urgent, right? As more and more people to me are, and that, okay, this is non-research based, non-evidence based, other than Jill's back of the bar napkin math. but to me, it seems that we are heading, if we thought we were in an autoimmune crisis prior to 2020, mm-hmm. even I think just the backlash from our bodies, even if you were healthy, mm-hmm. and maybe you didn't have COVID or you didn't have long COVID, but you were still isolated and there was all the things that go on that are parts of how your immune system functions and forms. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we are it's like a snowball coming down a hill that's turning into this giant mm-hmm. snowball. I don't know, mm-hmm. my analogy's bad today, but I feel like we don't even have any idea how big it's going to get, right?
I
think we are in, I mean, I look around and I hear all the things people talk about, and maybe it's because 3 years has gone by in my life and I'm older and everyone I know is older, but I like to think that we're at a different baseline than we used to be as human beings. Mm-hmm. And we collectively suffered trauma and this post-war, post-illness.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, I think we got to fix our healthcare systems sooner than later. And we got to figure out how to, for us in particular, how do we put this disease at the forefront of people's minds?
I see people just in, the Facebook groups and things like that. And it breaks my heart. Because going into this, I mean, I had some medical, before diagnosis, I knew where to go to look and things like that, I guess. And then, but these folks coming in now, first of all, for whatever reason, there just seems to be a lack of rheumatologists. Right. And even before the pandemic, just what folks knew about AS and that group of, you know, HLA B27 diseases was archaic. So many people were hearing, well, that's a man's disease. You can't have that. And yes. Now we know it's one for one with men and women. And then they, right. And they would say, well, you're not fused, so you can't have, well, that's, now we know that's an end. You don't want to ever get there. That's right. Like, you know, end stage. So hopefully with things like what SAA is doing, it is going to, at least when people go looking, they're going to find something. But I find, you know, in those groups that folks just, they just no idea. They know nothing about this. They can't get in with a doctor. And if they do, they're not getting good care. So they're suffering. And that's, that is just heartbreaking that people are suffering and they don't need to be, they don't, you know, it's unnecessary. Yeah. And then the absolute fear that they have over biologics and things like that, we just, so it's people like, you know, us and other leaders who are in those groups and we're like, no, go to, and I always send them to the Spondylitis Association, of course, but, it's scary. It's scary. And then don't even get me started on having to fight for your medication because insurance companies deny everything just right out of the gate.
Yeah. Right. It is. Yeah. It's, yeah, we're not in a good, okay. I don't like to get doom and gloom on anything, but
I know.
How are we going to illuminate the opportunity to solve these things? I'll say that. So, mm-hmm. Okay. I got a couple more questions and then we're going to wrap here. Okay. Is there anything that you run into? This is a little like off our topic, but is there any ethical considerations related to occupational therapy?
You know, it's interesting. I was reading that question in particular and a few times, and I don't see that there is. I don't know if you want to give me a hint, but I don't see an ethical concern. You don't have one? Yeah, I don't. I mean, I just really, I don't. I mean, barrier to entry, possibly, as far as maybe not having insurance or not knowing what you need kind of thing. But as an ethical concern?
Yeah, I don't know either. I didn't write that question.
Okay.
There was a backstory there. How do you communicate or how did you communicate with your patients? Or what did you find useful for communicating with patients about their treatment goals and progress? Like, how does that unfold?
I think all therapists, you know, are different. But I just try to connect. I want to know them. I want to know their why. I want to know who they were before. And I want to know, best case scenario, what would that look like for them? And then let's talk about how we're going to get there. It's really important for me to know the person. You know, they're never their condition or their injury or anything like that. I just always want them, anyone I work with, to leave better than they came. And I want to essentially fill their toolbox, you know, just equip them as best as I can for them to do the things that they want to do in their life.
Yeah. And how long do you usually, like, would a typical person, is it like a 3 month, 6 month, or is it based on insurance?
It's based on insurance. And I mean, 4 to 6 weeks is usually, it just depends on the reason, you know, that they're coming in, you know, twice a week or whatever for that period of time. And then, I mean, too, if I feel like we are making progress and they're not there and we can still make progress, you know, we'll ask for more time.
Right.
And then, you know,
keep going.
Yeah.
Okay. So as we wrap our time up here, what is the one thing about spondylitis that gives you hope for the future for the people living with it?
I mean, I think things like this is great. Like you said, getting getting the word out there. You know, this is an aside, but I remember when Liz and I did our first meeting, or we did our first, support group meeting. It was the first time that many of us that met had seen another actual real life person with spondylitis. It was the first time. That's crazy. I mean, that's really crazy.
That is crazy. You know, I remember, so in 2018, there was a big support group leaders meeting when I was first starting out in support group. I think at the time there were 50 or 55 support group leaders, mm-hmm. and most of us met in Denver, and then Spartan did a patient summit during mm-hmm. that, and I think it was a couple hundred people. But I remember one of the people who was there with us, because I mean, that was the first large scale group I'd ever been around of people who all shared the same disease. Wow. And we were walking up the stairs. We were staying in like a Hilton in Denver, and we were walking up the stairs, and somebody toward the back was like, "You guys all walk the same."
Like, no.
It was like, that is what, and somebody may have taken a picture. It was like, this is what people with spondylitis look like from behind.
What an observation.
Yeah. And everybody kind of like shuffles up the stairs and like has like, doesn't quite move very, you know, like other right. people. But yeah, it's crazy. I've met a number of people, and I think it's isolating, right? And SAA brings this community. It's super unique, I think, for caring for people. So I mean, that's what drew me. And I will be honest, I burned out very quickly on support group. So I appreciate all the support group leaders, because it's can be a mm-hmm. hard role. Yeah. And I probably wasn't mentally I wasn't probably in a good enough place to support other people at mm-hmm. the time. But that I think has evolved, but it's a very, it's a really important role. So you guys are doing them in New Mexico.
Well, so we had to hand it over because we both, and that's why we did it together, because we knew it was going to be a lot. Yeah. And these are not your standard support groups. I don't know if you've been in other, for other conditions or whatever. These are support groups. I mean, we bring a lot to them, and we take it very seriously. And we, you know, we're not, we do have our round tables, of course, and there's a lot of value in those. But, you know, the experts that the support group leaders bring in, and kind of the sharing across the country of, that's been, that's wonderful. But they're not all like that. So, I mean, really kudos to the SAA support groups, because they really are supporting. And that could be why you felt the way you did, and why we had to step down, because they are that helpful for people, and they take a lot, you know.
Yes, they're very intense for some people. Yeah.
So we did have to step down, and one of the members of the group took it over, and she's doing a great job from what we've heard.
Awesome.
These things that are happening, and you know, the social media that SAA has out there and stuff. It's just and then too that the the College of Rheumatology. A few years ago, we had redone the categories of spondylitis.
Right.
And I think that has helped quite a bit, because, you know, ankylosing spondylitis, I mean, it means a certain thing, and not all of us have that ankylosing part, thankfully.
Yeah, thankfully. Yeah. And I think that has helped increase awareness, because I think mm-hmm. it starts to also fold women and their symptoms much more. And again, not a research doc, but I see that it seems to, like, it covers women better, and where our symptoms show up.
The newer designations. I agree.
So we always joke at times, like, both, it doesn't matter which name you have, half the people who come across the name just like put it out of their brain, because they're like, yeah, I don't know how to say that.
I can't even say that one. Yeah, I know.
So,
and And wait till you get it with psoriatic involvement or which and with enteric, you know, this.
Right. Yeah. With enteric. Yeah, I know.
Lots of word salad stuff, but there.
Yeah.
But I think it helped because now we have that peripheral category, you know, as well. And
yeah.
And if you said before, if you said, oh, well, it's in my, you know, my neck. Well, that's not spondylitis.
Or your wrists or your hands or your.
Yeah, right.
100%.
Right, exactly. So that's been very, very helpful. So
see, we're making progress. We just need it. It needs to be faster and bigger.
I know.
All right, Miss Jean Drennan. This has been lovely.
I hope it was helpful.
So hope we get to do we get to see each other again soon.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, it would be great. And yeah, I think in closing, I mean, like, I'm grateful. I hope you continue to write or dictate or whatever you like to do, because I think you're.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And it fills your cup, I think. Right. So
it does. And I miss it tremendously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And keep in touch and keep us posted on what you're up to. You never know, like the next 14 habits to extraordinary wellness might be coming soon.
It might,
you never know. But thank you for joining us and talking with us about OT. And yeah, we'll do it. We'll have to do a check-in in the not too distant future.
Thank you for having me, Jill. It's been so fun.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie.
Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.